Hello, and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. Rachel Connolly is a writer and critic from Belfast who lives in London. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, Gawker, Hazlitt, The Cut, amongst others. She had a story in the summer issue of The Stinging Fly in 2021, and her debut novel, Lazy City, will be published next year by Canongate. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you like to read from the story for a little while?
Of course. I think I'm just going to read the start because The thing I really liked about this story was that it just starts in like the consciousness of the person, and it's very, very clear and sort of direct and urgent in that sense. So, okay, so this is from Rustlers by Michael McGee, and it starts, it says, I was turfed in the back with nothing but a toolbox to sit on. There were wee drawers full of screws that rattled as the van went, and it went all right. My dad drove like a demon, chucking me left and right through every dip and turn. I need a piss, I called, but he couldn't hear. I stood up, put my mouth to the gap in the chipped wood panel between the front and back, and told him I was bursting. You've got a bottle in there, he shouted back. Piss in the bottle. The 2-litre bottle of Coke was half empty and flat, so I stood up and undid my jeans. It was a rigmarole behind with the van belting around corners and me clawing out for something to hold on to while targeting my purple helmet in the hole and squeezing a drip. Ended up wetting my hand, but still near filled the bottle, the piss going a funny shade of black mixed in with the Coke. Stop there, I think, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So can you talk to me a little bit why you chose Rustlers by Michael McGee? Tell us about the story.
Yeah, it's a story, I guess, about a son and father exchange and that kind of like complicated family dynamic of a sort of like a parent relationship with a lot of tension. And I always find that stuff quite interesting and how you represent that quite interesting and how you do it in a way that is not condemnatory of any of the characters. And I thought that was quite good because I think Michael's portrayal of the dad is not totally unsympathetic. I thought that was really, really, you know, the dad comes off as this kind of chaotic figure who has a son and is still having one night stands and still out doing all of his old stuff with his old friends and trying to maybe merge those lives in a way that they don't quite fit. So I thought that that was a really clever thing he managed to do, which was having, you know, like the child's perspective of feeling really annoyed and let down by his dad. But at the same time, you could also see the dad's perspective of like trying to sort of like manage having a child when he's probably someone who shouldn't have. And I thought that was a kind of like very sensitively done. And I thought I like Michael, the immediacy of Michael's writing, like the sort of like, you get a lot of like the sound of things, the way things looked and felt passing by. And I think that sort of sensory side of his writing is a real strength. So I thought it'd be kind of nice to talk about it in that way. And I like the dialogue as well, it's brilliant. And that's something that's kind of like a big thing for me. I think in fiction is like more than plot, is like characterism and dialogue. And I think that the sort of voice of all of his characters comes through really, really strongly, which I thought was really good. Mm-hmm. Well done.
I agree with all of that. Something I also love about the story is this, its willingness to stay in the present moment. It gives a lot of like, you get a lot from just like very few short details without having to go into flashback or anything. It's just kind of the economy of that prose. Is that something you would look for in your fiction? That kind of ability to achieve something in a few short sentences or in fiction you admire?
That's so true. The thing of not kind of going into big heady flashbacks, because that is really something I like feel so strongly about. It takes away from... I think the thing of like trying to kind of represent a consciousness, if it's all of a sudden I remembered every few paragraphs, then it's like, that's not what consciousness is actually like. You know, the minute you start jamming in paragraphs of a different tense, I find it jarring. I find it sort of like, it's almost trying to do like the third person in the first person, I think, when you do that, which is sort of like, I just don't think it ever really, really works, and it does read in a sort of like naturalistic way. And I thought, yeah, you're totally right. That was like one of the elements. I think there's only a couple of things in that story where he brought in like a tiny bit of background and one sort of like future, I'll probably do this. And I thought that was like sort of really nicely done, because you get that immediacy and you get, and you know, the fact of like a child's impression as well, like, children don't have a long memory span. They're not kind of sitting ruminating on things in the way that we as adults often are.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that, you know, that the idea that you'd have this child who was ruminating on this like bad daddy is just like not realistic. but he gets a couple of like, yeah, I think even that, that when he calls him daddy and then he's like, I never call him daddy. You just get small little things like that, which just say so much more than if you had some big leaden.
I don't call him daddy.
And you'll never guess the last time I called him daddy. I think that sort of the lack of like needing to kind of go and draw back more. And so I think that was really, really clever and really well done. So I think there's a kind of freshness to that story, which is totally for that reason.
Yeah, definitely. And also it allows a kind of the pace. I think it's a really wonderfully paced story, and everything that's kind of hurtling is feels sort of inevitable because he doesn't keep dragging you back and forth and back and forth. Like, you know, like, these kind of like I really felt that he had possibly written the father son relationship and then deleted a lot of the kind of extraneous stuff. And I always feel that can you sense that? It's a great story. Of course, you're from Belfast and Mick is also from Belfast.
Yes.
And I have read his wonderful novel that's coming out next year called Close to Home. And something I've noticed is both in the novel and the story is his alertness to his like physical environment. I'm thinking of that opening description of the van. Is that something you think about in your own writing as like the present moment, what's around you kind of, or is that what you respond to?
Yeah. So like my novel's all in present tense apart from some sections. And I try to keep physical in my own stuff. I try and keep physical stuff to a minimum and just sort of have a couple of try and do it in as few sentences as possible to get the physical environment. So I do a lot of like smell and what, you know, like just two lines about what something feels like. And I try and do it that way to try and sort of have it almost like I think ideally I'd have it almost like you can feel like you were seeing exactly what this person was seeing, but in as few as possible. So I kind of try and keep the sort of like very, very descriptive stuff to a minimum, but I think the stuff that he does with sound, I thought was really, like, you can kind of hear the van rattling around in the background. I thought that was really, really clever. And I thought that was really, that was really good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's extremely hard to write something, I think, from a child perspective. Like, I think it's one of those things that it's really difficult to do. It can come across as kind of twee or like giving them like... Yeah, and like knowledge that they shouldn't have. They're like, oh, I saw this on the news. You're like, you're seven. But like, I feel that it's something
some
that
like within the child.
Wow, capitalism. I feel like it's something he does with great. He does it really brilliantly here. Have you ever attempted a child narrator voice in any of your...
No, I don't. I don't think I could do it justice. I think the hackneyed, I think I have like that terrible cynical way of seeing everything, and I think it would seep too much into the child. You would get the capitalism or the like whatever. Yeah. I'm too much of an Aquarius to write a child's perspective, I think.
I can't think of many. I know when someone does it really well, like what I'm thinking of specifically is Foster by Claire Keegan. It's like incredibly moving, but I can't think of, any others off the top of my head. In your own story, In the End, in the summer 2021 issue.
Yes.
I really enjoyed that story and I reread it in anticipation of this. But it's a sort of dystopia, but also incredibly kind of subtly done. Mm-hmm. As in when I was reading, I was picking up on more stuff. It's written from a point of view where people have kind of accepted their new lives. I'll quote from it. That night was the end of that phase for me of feeling so angry and overwhelmed all the time about the life we've been condemned to on this dying planet. Angry at everyone who came before and carelessly made this place with no future, and angry at myself at the same time for not being able to cope with it. Can you talk a little bit about this story? Where did it come from?
I'm quite interested in the idea of like that. I feel like there's a lot of disaffection among young people now with like the structures and systems as they exist, and that can sometimes manifest as a like, oh, like you very utopian, like if the capitalism went away, I would be like in the, I'd be in the communist utopia and I'd be like the pet photographer and I'd be photographing all the pets and it would just be like, I'd just be like lying in bed ordering delivery because it would be free like in the communist utopia. And I think that is obviously like a bit silly, but I wanted to kind of push apart like if it wasn't capitalism and it was something that was not about growth, and was more about preservation. I wanted to see like what would that actually look like. So it wouldn't necessarily, it wouldn't look like office jobs, but would it look like, it would look like having to recycle everything, you know, it wouldn't look like producing new clothes or producing new objects. So it was kind of like looking at that idea of like what stagnation would actually look like. Yeah, what living in a system like that where you're just sort of like trying to keep it going at this like base level. And I think I kind of pushed it a bit more into the future, I think, because it seemed there was something unrealistic about just having it tomorrow, because I felt like more would have to go wrong for that to happen. And I kind of was like sort of like pushing out to a point where it's almost like you're in the middle of the climate apocalypse, but you're just sort of like everything's just keeping stuff going and keeping it ticking. And I kind of thought like, yeah, I kind of thought it was an interesting I really like that world. I'll probably go back there sometime and do something else in there because it's sort of like an interesting place to sort of like play about. And the I was interested in it, and I think this comes up in my nonfiction too, is like the idea of different types of people being adapted to different structures and systems. And I think the type of person who does well in the world as it is wouldn't necessarily do well in that type of world. And it's like that question too of like, you know, the type of person who's really, really motivated by money, would how would they live then, what would their motivation be, what would they, and I think that was like, I think in an early draft there was loads of that stuff which probably I think most of it got taken out, but I think yeah, that just has a space to think through like what does that mean about types of people, like how does that, what does that mean about the way that we like interact with each other and stuff. Is a big long rant.
No, it's very interesting because in the previous episode I was talking to Susie Dickey about a story she picked and we were talking about dystopic fiction and things, and I was saying that like so much of it is, I don't know, almost like this kind of like fantasy of annihilation where you have to like live in this kind of, you know, only you can survive in this extremely difficult environment. But just you, and like
it's
maybe
like the hottest person is the best at surviving.
Yeah. So it's like you and one other person, and yeah, they're not as good as you though. But like I, and then this feels much more realistic to me that we'll have to, you know, probably not very far from now, survive with less, and what will that kind of look like? So yeah,
you know what was funny about that story is that the I noticed when people messaged me about it or like friends read it or whatever, some people would be like, that is so dystopian, like it's a terrible place. And then some would say like, that seems brilliant. Which is funny because it is like, it is a types of people thing. Like to some people the idea of doing a lot less and just being able to like go out dancing all the time is a great idea. Probably the form of it reflects some of my own but yeah, it's an interesting place.
No, that, I did love that about the story, like all that kind of hanging around coffee shops and just hanging out with your pals and discussing the night before. I was like, I think I do actually fine. I think I've become like a leader in this new world. It's actually something I like about you and Mick's work, and Mick does quite really well in the novel, less so the story, but in his book that's coming out next year, is this kind of array of characters that you kind of, in your short story you did as well, that you bring in, and you know, their acquaintances or their people they just see from around or their parties and things, and it's really reflective of like a social life that you would have in your, you know, your 20s and your early 30s or whatever, or whatever social life you'll have in your life, rather than this kind of tight novelistic kind of where someone just has like one friend, or I really feel that is like just much more kind of realistic. You might see this person again, then again, you might not see them again. But they still like have a relationship with them. Can you talk about how you write that? Yeah.
That is something I like think a lot about. Yeah. And I'm excited to hear that about Michael's book as well. Like I'm so excited to read that book. But I think, yeah, basically I feel like it's tricky because I think what people like generally understand as plot involves a couple of characters and their relationships progressing. But I think that like in all of us in life, like our relationship with ourselves develops a lot through sometimes quite tangential interactions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that feels to me quite like, in terms of character development, like I actually don't know how you'd really do it with just having the thing with like two friends. And I don't know anyone who just has two friends, or if they do, they're like a very stunted individual. But the, but I think I've in the novel, there's a couple of, I think my favorite character is one who only comes into a couple of scenes, and he's quite tangential, but he's sort of like, he's representative of a type of person who I know a lot of people like this. And I kind of wanted to have someone like this in the book, to have someone who was of this type. He's just a real like wreckhead, basically. But he's like, but he's someone who's just really not, he's a really like good person as well. And it's sort of like, I think that type of character is someone who like, you always enjoy spending time with them, even if you don't see them every single day. And yeah, I think you can kind of like, you know, you can stay up late talking with that kind of person and actually like end up realizing something that you wouldn't have realized otherwise. And I feel like that, yeah, trying to like recreate that type of interaction is a really worthwhile like project to me, because it does feel, it does feel very true to life. But it's like, I feel like it is tricky because you get into the, it's tricky because I think that some people don't see it as plot, or don't see it, or they see it as like circular, or like why is this going back and forth. But I think if you can do it in a precise enough way or something, maybe it can still, maybe it can still not be circular. And well, we hate plot, so
well, me too. but also, I hope I'm not talking too much about mixed novel.
No.
There's a lot of kind of parties and a lot of kind of the relationships kind of, and the things you kind of discover about yourself when you like stay out late, or when you're like drinking in a large group of people and things like that. And I feel like I felt like when I was reading Mixed Book, I was like, I haven't read anything quite like this in a while, even though it's, you know, such an obvious kind of thing that we all do. And is that something you would kind of, that kind of realism, do you like to reflect that in your own fiction?
Yeah, there's a lot of like late nighters and things. I think it's just like, I think there's a type of book that is not, that has been quite popular for the past like wee while, and this isn't like a slight because I often really like these books, but it's a lot of like it's within a milieu of people who are like very bookish, and so a lot of it is very like, they sort of like sit up and have like two glasses there, you know, they like drink red wine with two of them, and they sit up and speak about books. And like, to me, that doesn't actually like, that's not something I do so often. So I think it's something I do
all the time.
You could kind of like, I feel like that type of thing where it's like, you know, that, and I think some of those books, not all of them, but some of them have a tendency to sort of do like literary criticism within the novel. And I think that type of book, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, but I think it only reflects one milieu, basically. And I think that's kind of, you know, if you're reading it and that's not your life, isn't that you like, we're sitting with all of your English undergrad people like arguing or whatever about politics. I think you can kind of read that and be like, was that the way it was for me? Not really. And I think maybe it's like subconsciously a reaction to that. I don't think it's conscious, but I think the thing of like, what does your life actually look like? It doesn't necessarily look like that. So how can you put it into terms in which it's a bit more,
into your fiction. Yeah, no, absolutely. And like, I feel, that was something that when I was reading Mixed Book, I was like, that's very refreshing, because I feel like, I don't know, these kind of, you know, late night sessions in the pub or whatever, they're kind of dismissed as unprofound, but like takes them to a very profound level. And it's, but I was like, they are, you know, at the same time when you're in them, like, you know, these people you're with, you're learning something about them.
And yeah, totally.
That relationship, just because it's based on, is not discounted as less, you know? So you're talking there about contemporary fiction, and I first encountered your work as a literary critic, which I think is very no-nonsense in a way I hugely admire. Can you talk to me about writing criticism as opposed to writing fiction?
Yes. I am such an argumentative person, and that's where it comes from. Yeah. I am just like constantly, I'm a very scrappy person. I have to tone it down a lot. And then in normal social situations, I have to be like, don't say it. So I think it's partly that, it's that side of my personality. You just see something that's like, I just have to say it. I can't not say it. I think a lot of the critical work I do is basically like tying together kind of trends in books or trends in pieces of writing. And I think I'm writing a bit more about books now, but you know what it is like? Because I actually never studied English. And I think for a long time, I had a bit of a imposter syndrome, like, oh, if I do a book review, it'll just be like, it was juxtaposition when this happened. everyone will be like, what's this? So I think I've done a lot of writing about kind of cultural trends and the tying together sort of trends in writing and stuff. Cause I think, I was scared to do a sort of straight book review for a while, but I'm doing a little bit more of that now. But yeah, I think, I think there's a type of writing which there's a bit more of now, which is nice, which is sort of like, not feeling so regimented about having to why you're writing a piece. So it's like, and I think that a lot of pieces I do are like that, where I'm like, I've just noticed everybody's talking about this, so I'll just tie it together and say, you know, everybody, like I did that with I did that essay on that pity me style of writing, where I was just like, why am I seeing this everywhere? And then you just kind of like tie it all together, which I think, I really like doing those pieces, because I feel like you can often say something like a bit broader about the stuff, a bit broader about the culture, because it is sort of like everywhere. It's like, why is this all around me? In a way that for just a one book review, it doesn't necessarily, but I guess, people do the groups of books, but yeah.
Yeah. And I never studied English either. as you could tell, I was thinking, because when I was saying before that when I really admire a book, I really don't want to know anything about it. Do you know? I think that I really feel that quite deeply. I don't want to know, you know, how they did it. I don't want to hear about their 300 drafts. I don't want to know about their life. I just want it to have arrived and, you know, that's it. And it's brilliant. And I guess I don't know why that is. That's just a personal thing. But then I feel like in criticism, it so much of it involves like unpacking the book and pulling the book apart, and you have to in order to make the review good.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel about, you know, trying to make something that is pretty good, fictional, and then having to look at it in fiction in a way that makes it less mysterious, you know?
Yeah, I think I think you can sometimes get, the thing that I find really energizing is reading a book review that I really don't agree with. So I think there's like, sometimes you read, I actually there's one I constantly reread because I hate it so much. But there's sometimes you read a review of a book and you're like, I do not,
what's the review?
I don't want to start a fight, but it's this piece that's I just don't agree with that at all. It's by I mean, she's not going to listen to this. It's by a writer who I just don't click with her writing at all. I don't like on a sentence level. I don't like she's called Becca Rothfeld. It's just like the stuff she says is always wrong. On a sentence level, it's ugly. I just do not vibe with it. But she wrote this big long piece about like morality literature, and it was just all over the place. It was so bad. And I just I constantly go back and reread it as a like, here's how you miss the mark, if you know what I mean. Like, to me, that would miss the mark. And it's that thing of just like, I think there's a thing of like trying to take the book, even if it's not for you, as what it was trying to do, and not put in like a false thing on top of it. And I think that's something that like, and I think there's a style of like aggro criticism, which is very like, pick apart this and sort of like hate read this. Yeah. And that so often is really actually very unsatisfying to read, because it's just picking a fight, but also because it's like, so often putting something that's just not quite right, like a sort of like a, what's the word for that? Like a, it's so often just like a straw man that's put on top of this book, and then you argue with a straw man, and I just find it so tiresome. And I think I find that really energizing in a way, because I read that and I'm like, there's a paragraph being like, in the text they did this, and then the sort of like, you make a point and you back it up sort of thing. They'll make the point and then they back it up with something that just doesn't quite map. And I just find it so like, that kind of really sends me around the bend. So I think I find that very sort of like energizing in a sort of like a how to read a book properly and write about it properly way, or how to write about anything properly way. So like, are you actually talking about the thing it was trying to do? Or are you putting something that you want to see onto it? Are you like, are you sort of putting what you think the author is like as a person, or what you think the author thinks as a person? Like, are you putting that onto it, or are you taking it from the text? Or the thing of like, I think sometimes there can be a lack of subtlety in like particularly fiction reviews, in terms of like anything you see on the page is something the author decided to put there. And I think sometimes there's a lack of like, you'll see this sometimes where it's like, the author couldn't help but let slip. And it's like, no, you deliberately saw that information on purpose in a very curated way. Like, yeah. It's not that this world just is there and the author is like going over with a sheet and like hiding bits from you. So I think that type of thing is very, but in a way as well, it's sort of like, I think it's good to be aware of like what, if you're writing fiction, it's good to be aware of what reviews are actually like, because loads of them just they don't really meet the text on its terms. And it's almost good to be like, you'll get crap reviews that you don't agree with at all, but they are just often like that. Like, they're not trying to meet you where you're at or see what you're trying to do. And like, I think that's actually a positive way to look at it from a personal sanity point of view.
I fully agree. And I think it's almost good to be a person if you are that reads reviews, because I think you come across so many that just like completely just don't engage and have actually no interest in engaging. If we're talking on like a personal level, what we can't stand about like certain reviews, my main two are when the person has clearly reviewed how the publishing company has marketed the book rather than how the person has written the book, which is so deeply unfair on the writer. And then also like just on an entertainment level. I'm a modern person. I like to be entertained all the time, but like I hate to be lectured in reviews. If I feel like the person is explaining the book to me.
Dogmatic, like, and I hate the sort of Sermon on the Mount, like, here's why I'm going to explain why this was dumb thing, which is just very like, which is a voice, which you do see. I think it's like, but to me, that's a young, like, obviously I'm young, but to me, that's a young critic's voice. Cause it's almost thing of having to boss people around to tell them off is almost like lacking in confidence a little bit. Cause it's sort of like, I think the charm and persuasion side of writing a kind of critical piece is much more of a tricky, difficult skill. But you know, the thing of like, if you make someone laugh in the first paragraph, you can probably get them to agree with you. I think that side of it is a little bit like, there's more subtlety there. And I think the sort of like, here's why it's stupid, here's why it's bad. I think to me, that's it reads to me as immature, but that's my personal preference.
Yeah, I'm similar. And it's a sort of like, if you like this, you're an idiot. Life is bad enough. I don't be told I'm an idiot like every single day. What critics do you admire, Rachel?
I love Perul Segal. I love when Mark O'Connell writes reviews. I think they're always really good. He doesn't do that so much anymore. And Human Beercat writes really good book reviews and really good short book reviews, which is really hard to do. Like, you know, he does. I feel like when you're doing like a big long essay, you can kind of almost, it's almost easier in a way. And he manages to say something quite interesting in like 800 or 900 words, which is always like good to see. And I've left loads of people out there, but I've left loads of like old people I always go back and reread out there. But those are three I like at the minute.
That's great. Yeah. I recently read your review of a book of essays in the New Republic. And I think you're talking about a book called The Crane Wife. And you say the weaknesses of many of the essays in The Crane Wife is that Hauser tends to the subjectivity of her experiences in favor of swapping generalities that don't quite ring true, particularly in statements about the women, way women are and how they act, and hence the form heterosexual relationships tend to take. You wrote an essay for Gawker entitled The Pity Me Personal Essay, which is a trend I've noticed but hasn't neatly been able to summarize. Can you talk about this essay, which is sort of linked a little bit to The Crane Wife?
I think there can be a very I think in the Pity Me essay, the point I kind of went into there was that there's been in the trend in fiction was sort of like the trauma plot and very like kind of like this shaken woman. And I think that has sort of dripped. I think I view that as having fed into nonfiction writing quite a lot. And it's created this environment where everything has to be so dramatic and everything has to be, and some of it has come, there's the writing about capitalism, which has to always be like, I'm there crushed onto the spokes, even though you're like a supermodel or like the head of it. Jeff Bezos is like, I was crushed under the spokes. you know, it's like, it's kind of, it's everybody, this thing of capitalism and how it was killing me thing. It's just so, you know, it's so hacked in. It's so overdone, but it's the way that I think people just write it, and then when anyone's going to look to see how you write it, they're like, oh, you just do this, you just do the hackneyed thing, like that's the way. And I think it just feeds, it becomes so like it's like a virus, it spreads like that way. And I think that there's that, and there's this kind of way of talking about work culture as well, which is like, obviously work's crap, and it's like work, particularly in like a, like work in an office job, an open plan office, is like so hellish. But I think this way of talking about it, where it's like, you know, productivity dysmorphia and stuff, there's a, it's really humorless, it's really like, it's too dramatic, it doesn't fit with the reality, which is just like, it's a bit boring, you play around in your spreadsheet and then you go home. So I think that was, it was kind of, yeah, a reaction to that. It's like, why are we talking like this? Why is this the way of relaying these experiences? Because to me, it's not, it's not relatable. It's so like, and I think just like a thing with, in the pandemic, I said, I can't remember if I said this in there or not, but there's a real like humorlessness to a lot of nonfiction writing at the minute. It's very serious, and it comes from this kind of, or I think it comes from this thing of like this way of writing, which kind of came up in the past like couple of years, which is like, oh, writing's not an important thing to do, I have to justify why I'm doing it, like, and the way I justify is it because I'm writing really serious and dramatic things, when in reality, like, it's entertainment. It's, it's very hard to justify writing as a useful thing to do. It's easy to justify as entertainment, and I think, but it's, it's hard to, like, as entertainment, it's harder to do. And I think this thing of like, why can't it just be funny and entertaining? Why can't it be a distraction? Like, to me, that's what it is. That's what it, that's what the purpose of it is. And I think and I think there's a bit of a thing of like, oh, I'm writing my very dramatic, serious pieces about how bad the capitalism was, and almost as if that makes it automatically a more valuable piece of work than if it's funny. And I just think like, it's not automatically more valuable. It's so much easier to do the, it's so much easier to do the melodrama and to do the, it's so much harder to do the, like, it's harder to do something that's actually fresh and weird and like, and yeah, I think there's a bit of a, like, there's a devaluing of the thing that I view as actually more valuable. But so that was the pity me essay, was just like, why are we talking like this? Please, please can we stop? But I think the, the Crane Wife is something that I am, I think there's a really nice warmth to CJ Hauser's writing, which is really lovely. Like, and she's very, like, I can't imagine any, even though she writes about a lot of intimate relationships in that book, I can't imagine anyone reading them and not feeling like they were well represented, because she is like extremely warm and fair to everyone who she interacts with, which is really, really, a really good quality. But yeah, the way of writing about heterosexual relationships, where it's always kind of like the woman is this like maligned figure, and the man is the sort of toxic man, and it just like, yeah, yeah. And as a woman of toxic experience, I find myself so, so misrepresented. But it's like this thing that doesn't ring true to life, and just also sort of seems like, I don't know, you can kind of imagine if you were in therapy and you were doing like, that I was this maligned figure and like my terrible boyfriend and he like forgot my birthday for the third time in a row, and I simply sat in studio. You can imagine the therapist being like, for the third time,
for the like, yeah.
And you're still in this relationship. And I think that is kind of a like, yeah, I think this sort of like the I view it as very disempowering to just have this narrative of like, these, we're all these put upon women and we have no agency, and all we can do is be in these terrible relationships with mismatched men, and like, well, we'll just have to put up with it then. I find it very like,
Or that you're totally incapable of like inflicting harm in a relationship, which is just like not true.
And the
I know enough women to know that's not true.
And also, I think it's like, it's sort of like very something I really, really hate is that I think often writing which is thinks it's being feminist is being actually very reductive of female behavior. And it's very like, these women are always these saintly and one-dimensional figures who like can't. And you see it too in the way that people talk about the way that people talk about like something like catcalling, where it's like, oh, it's the worst thing that's ever happened, it has to all be like made illegal, and you know, if you're a woman, that's the worst thing you have to deal with. And I'm like, for most women, is that the worst? Like, for a normal adult, for an adult woman, is that? I don't say it myself. So they I think this flattening of every uniform women uniformly as these kind of like very retiring and sort of like put upon figures who just like are very sort of like, they'll never do you any harm because they themselves can barely like function, and it just
and they're just waiting around for harm to be done to them, and then they deal with the consequences of harm,
and then they'll sort of lie licking their wounds. Yeah,
that's like, you know, like, and that's where that kind of like, you know, a strong female character, whatever, comes about, that the idea that women can't be ambitious or, you know, exploitative or like incredibly like selfish or greedy, like that's all ridiculous, like, you know, of course they can. You write really well in that essay, about that. I haven't read Emily Ratajkowski's book, but the part chapter in the book where she goes on holidays and she's like, it's awful, this free holiday I am on. Capitalist, you know?
That was actually, you should read that chapter. It's worth a read. If it'd be fair to Emily, I would say that I imagine what happened with that book is that she read a lot of the other recent essay collections and was like, here's what you do in your essays. You just write the capitalism's bad, the people, they love it. And then she kind of just did the same thing. I don't know. If she genuinely thinks her life is that bad, there's something more serious going on there. But it's like, I feel like it's sort of, she kind of aped that style and just put it onto her own life. And it was just that at its most ridiculous. Because it was, it was like an all expenses like day trip to this like luxury, like, you know, like villa and Bali with like an infinity pool. She was like swimming around this infinity pool. And there's a thing she does in that essay, which is so common, which is like, she kind of complains about, and she does this actually quite a few points in that book, where she complains about rich people. So it's like, she's on, she's like this sort of like global supermodel who is on this like all expenses paid trip. And she's, to pay for the trip, she has to post like one photo from Instagram. And she's like, and the other people here, they were rich. To cap it all off, the other guests at the hotel are rich. But I think there is that way of talking about wealth and class, and that it's always presenting the protagonist as this very like put upon figure, when it, you know, like a supermodel is less rich than Jeff Bezos, but not than most people.
Exactly. And where do you think this desire for pity comes from? Like, where do you think that this trend has arise from?
I think it's that trauma plot thing of like everything has to be dramatic, everything has to be bad. But it's all, I think it's just, it's easier to write like that. Like, it's easier to kind of just bung in loads of adjectives and write in this very modern way and think that you've done something really big. And it's, you know, it's totally unoriginal. And I guess that's part of it, is that like you just sort of like bung in your bit about capitalism, you stick in your bit about the rich people, and that's like it, the piece, it writes itself. And
I think it's infinity. It's not deep enough.
Being a woman, capitalism, rich people, it's all
calling.
And I think, it's that you don't have to think through yourself what the holiday was actually like, or how to represent the holiday. And I think as well, it's come about this idea that people find it easier to relate to this pitiful figure, which I don't think is true at all. Like, I think I can't imagine a normal person reading that essay and being like, oh, so bad to be on holiday. Like, I think most people would read it and for God's sake. And I think that it's that thing of human nature where not totally having enough, I guess, insight or self-awareness to think like, what would a normal person think of when they read this? Would they think it was so bad for me to be on holiday? Or would they actually want to hear what the crack was? Like, would you not? So I think people love reading about like glamour and people love celebrity stuff. Like, you know, the reason that Emily Ratajkowski has like however many million Instagram followers is because they love the glamour. They love the insight into, you know, they like seeing the thing her fans like is that they get to see the infinity pool. Like, tell me about the infinity pool. Don't tell me
I know. And there are so many of those kind of like supermodel, I read one of the Janet Dickens autobiography. I read it, I think it was like three times on all these ones. But it is, you're sort of like reading about a life different from your own, and you don't need any qualifiers. They don't need someone at the start being like,
obviously,
because you're already entered into that contract where it's just like, I know that your life is probably better than mine, and
that's why I'm reading it.
But back to that point about kind of female characters and the way they're being constantly kind of portrayed as victims. As I was just before I came on the podcast, I was giving out about Blonde, the new Andrew Dominik film, like, it's a very brutal portrayal of Marilyn Monroe, where she suffers probably every indignity possible. Actually, I think I'm like, was she catcalled in the film? I'm pretty sure she is more than once. But I just wonder, like, and at no point does she have any kind of agency, or does she enjoy kind of her own sexuality or anything like that? Or does she enjoy being desired and things? And I feel like with all this constant like talk of like all this portrayal of like female characters and things, that we are taking steps backwards. I feel like I'm seeing more kind of reductive, progressive portrayals than I've probably ever seen before in the last maybe year or so.
Completely. I completely agree. I think I think there was like the strong, I think the strong independent woman thing became the girl boss. And then there was a whole backlash to that, which was warranted, you know, like that was, you know, the backlash to that was appropriate. But I think that has now transmuted into like the woman again as like star prime victim. And I think that is like, it's just, it's horrible territory to be in. It's so, it's bleak to read. It's bleak to like watch. Yeah. It's so, I find it so like, you know, it's actually quite, I wrote an essay, I think it'll be out this week, but it's, written this about like, not exactly about the presentation of women in film, but about this, about how to like reckon with misogyny in a way that is not, and reckon with living as a woman in a misogynistic society, which is not constantly in this presentation of this woman crying in the shower. Because it is difficult, because I notice myself, like if you don't relay your experiences in a certain way, you don't really get sympathy for them. And I think like a lot of that stuff, people think they're being feminist, but they're being as misogynistic as a builder on building site, where it's like, if you can't really describe a sexual assault still and not say that you were kind of traumatized after in this very legible way of like that you were crying in the shower and you weren't going out and you were like locked in your house for a year after. And that's such a misogynistic portrayal of female sexuality, because it's that thing of like the sort of like scarlet woman. I don't even know if people realize they're doing it, but the idea that if a woman is sexually assaulted, she instantly responds in this very prescribed way of like essentially locking herself in her castle in a turret. It is just, it's totally like, it's my big bugbear of mine, but it's a sad truth that if you do not relay your experiences in that way, in that mold, you don't get any sympathy, and you don't get, and you almost get sort of like, there was a good piece in Gawker, which basically was like, was a woman writing about the fact that she had been quite brutally like attacked in the street and she had PTSD after it, and she worked through the PTSD in therapy, and she was basically saying like a lot of this discourse about not going out at night and stuff, it's actually like, that's, we shouldn't be advertising that as a response, because it's not a healthy response, it's not a good fear mechanism, like we shouldn't be leaning into that. And she went into quite a lot of detail about her own experiences and how they'd formed it, like the fact that she had been through this, had suffered PTSD from it, and then had gone to therapy and was now at the point of living a more or less normal life. And people went absolutely mad at her for it, like that she was like undermining female trauma. And she was like, how is it that you can say, it was just one of those things where it was like, how is it that if my experience doesn't fit X, I'm undermining the one that we're only allowed to see, which is the one that you see in films. And it's just, it's so, I find the whole thing is so, it's so reductive of what trauma even is. And it's and I don't know if they realize it, but it's what a lawyer does in court to discredit a victim. You know, they say like, oh, if you were raped on this date, how come you were out drinking the next week? That's literally what they say. And it's like, to me, I can't see, there's no water between those two things. You know, there's no water between that and the, if you're not locking yourself in at night, it's because you haven't suffered adequately. Like to me, there's no air between that. And I find that whole stuff. But I think that kind of like as a female presentation, I think is just, it's like really dragging us back to the dark ages. It's very, I find it like, you know, like actually quite disturbing that it's women who are promoting this thinking that it's progressive.
I was watching that and I was just like, this is so kind of, you know, totally incurious, and he thinks he's being so edgy by showing, you know, her like trauma over and over. I think she is crying for nearly the entire film. And I was like, it would be so much better. Like, I'm sure at some point, like Marilyn Monroe, like enjoyed.
And this is Marilyn Monroe. Yeah. Who like, seduced the president? Marilyn Monroe, who seduced the president.
Yeah,
like,
but everything. What? Yeah. But like, she's not allowed to enjoy any of that, you know? Like, which is, I just think it's such a backwards way. And I feel like I'm seeing a lot of it now. It's kind of disappointing.
Yeah, it's a really like, I understand that if you were a male director now making a film about a woman from the 40s, I feel like there's almost a pressure on you to do it like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I feel, you know, like that you're almost like, that you're almost sort of like with a gun to your head being like, cry more.
Yeah.
But I think, but I think it's a really like, it's a horrible, horrible thing. I also like, it worries me that that's what we're telling 16-year-old girls, that you should be like in your house all the time just to prove that you're like the appropriate type of woman. I just, I hate it.
No, I agree. You write in that same Gawker essay that Be it funny or serious, good personal writing is honest, confident, and singular. It doesn't feel defensive or caveated. Why can't I talk? Or generic. Perhaps above all, there is a sense of faith in the listener, the reader, the audience, and other people, really. I think this is a really good description of interesting writing generally, fiction or nonfiction. It's what I look for in writing, this kind of trust. Do you think that's hard to find, or is that what you kind of look for in fiction as well?
Yeah, that's a great, but I think that's why I love your fiction so much, especially, like, I think whenever I read your, I read that short story you'd written, I can't remember the name of it now, but the other week it was really funny, but I think when I read your fiction, I'm like, I find this really funny, but I don't know if everyone would. And I'm sure probably everyone would.
Sure,
but
they definitely don't now.
It's the feeling that it's just for me. It's like that. And I think that you there's a sense that you're risking of something by not spelling it out and by not being like, you know, the sort of like honk honk, like, and it was funny and it was funny this way. And I think that the sense of that being the sort of slight risk that you take is actually like just so much of a better payoff, I think, as a reader. And yeah, I think that's the quality I look for a lot in writing. The idea that something has been crafted for you specifically is actually such a rare thing. And I think that that feeling of like that they haven't, and like I think like a lot of non-fiction at the minute is like pretty bad because it's like very, very defensive, very stock, very formulaic. And you can blame like the way the editors are and the internet for some of it, but you can't blame it for all of it. Like some of it's just people just be lazy.
I recently read Emmanuel Carrere's latest book, Yoga.
And I haven't read that yet. It looks really good.
It is really good. And like he's like annoying, which I'm sure I can say freely. People probably agree with me. But like at the same time, I was like, he doesn't have that defensive thing because I really don't think he cares. Like I really don't think he's interested in anyone liking him or being like, he's cool or like, I feel like he's just moved. Perhaps it's because it's like he's older. And he just doesn't have the internet like language or whatever. But like that felt very refreshing. Do you know? He wasn't being like,
don't cancel me.
Or being like, I'm so sorry for owning like two houses, or I'm going to my holiday home in France. He's just like, I went to my holiday home. Like that kind of thing.
Totally.
Whereas I was like, this is sort of like a bit refreshing after what I feel like I'm constantly reading.
It's totally like you read, even that's why like reading old essays from like way before the internet is really refreshing, because you kind of like get that sense of like the person will joke about their seven houses and I'm like, now everyone will be like, no, you can't joke, but it's like, well, you own them anyway, whether you joke or not, the seven houses remain the same. And it's just like I think that quality of older writing is something I really, really, really try not to write for like a cancel in mind. I try it so much to just be like, to almost push it and see how far you can get it. Because I just think it's so like, it's such a sorry way to live. And it does end up in all of the writing being the same and being like really, really over caveated and having the same stuff in. It's even like privilege disclaimers that people stick into everything, or like I call it like anti-cancellation talisman, where you're like, oh, like by the way, like I'm a white woman, so like I know it's like it's like everybody knows who's a white woman. That doesn't, I don't know, like if you're gonna do a proper passage in the piece about that in some about how it relates specifically to something and actually talk properly about black women or women of color, like completely do that. But if it's just there as a tick box, I personally would think it's quite insulting. Like I think it's just, if you're literally just putting it there as a like don't cancel me thing, like don't speak about it at all, just leave it out, because it's like, you know, it has that vibe of like, now no one can say I didn't say it, just disrespectful.
I do think, you know, this kind of, you're talking about like melodrama and like this kind of like fixation in contemporary publishing on like the trauma part and like sad and serious stories, which I fully agree with. Do you think that has kind of led to like humor being undervalued in writing now?
I totally think, but I think it's like, I think we're maybe due a comeback because I think it's been really undervalued, but I think people are like really hungry for it actually. People actually go, like, I wrote this piece on like gossip during the pandemic. I was like either people are going to be really angry about this, because it was just like silly, but it was like all of these stories of like the gossip I'd gathered during the pandemic. And it wasn't like, you know, I didn't put anything about like,
oh, everyone was having a terrible time, but just I didn't put any of that stuff into it. It was just the gossip. And I was like, either people are going to like really, really be like angry about this, or they'll like it because they'll see it as a, but people were like really went mad for that piece in a way that I was like, I do think there's a bit of a hunger for that type of thing where it's just funny. And it's just like, it's sort of like, yeah, it's just funny. And it's just bringing you something that's just a little bit like different to what you were expecting to see.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely a real sort of like desire for that at the minute.
I think that unexpected is like something that I am hungry for, you know, like, and I think I could see it in this story by Mick as well, you know, like he kind of totally like avoids it purposefully. And I think a story can do that, like avoids the melodrama. He cuts the melodrama completely. And like a lot of the responses in there, like sort of unexpected, kind of what the father and the friend do is sort of unexpected too. And I feel like that is something when I read now that I'm constantly kind of looking for, even if it's just like a line of dialogue or a single sentence that is not where it should be, do you know?
Yeah, I love that bit in that story where it's like, I can't remember the exact line, but it's like my dad would take me back, or he would bring back a woman whose heels would scrape the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I love that description because it's like, I could picture this child, like male child, like this little boy being like, as these like high heels were like crashing across the floor. And I thought that was such a good, like, and I thought that was so good because it was like, that could have been a real kind of like, and I will lie in my bed and my daddy will be downstairs. But instead it was these like this high heels, and I could picture the woman that it would be would have this kind of like red high heels, and she would be like opening a champagne bottle kind of there, like a Prosecco bottle. Probably.
She's having a great time.
She's having this time for life.
Yeah.
But the and I felt that was like, I thought that was like such a good example of that, where it's like totally wasn't, you know, that I wasn't expecting that paragraph to end on that line, but it was such a good line. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you, so I read another essay you wrote called The Brand as Late Capitalism. And you've talked about like writing these kind of trend pieces and things, and you're very good at it, and like breaking down what makes everything so irritating. But how do you find your nonfiction writing? Because you've written articles about Tinder and the blandness of social media influencers. I really enjoyed that piece, by the way. And observations about how we live now. How do you find that feeds into your fiction?
Yeah, I wouldn't have a career at all if it wasn't for my pieces. That's where I've like kind of come from. And I think I've learned to write from doing like the nonfiction stuff, I think. And I've learned like to, I think it's made me braver about what I would do in fiction, I think, because something that I've been like happy with nonfiction pieces is that you'll do a piece that you're like, oh, it's going to go down, and it can actually go down much better than you were expecting. And you kind of like, if you say something and people agree with it, like it doesn't matter if it wasn't the thing people were saying before, or if it's like, if it's a bit challenging, because the capitalism one, like I think there's been a couple more people have started, that's kind of become the way of talking about it now. But at that time, like everyone was really like, capitalism's killing me, man. And I was like, people are going to be like really annoyed about this because it's going to be a like, and you kind of have all this stuff in your head, and then you do it and you realize that everybody thought the same as you did. And I think that that's definitely like made me braver in fiction than I would have been if I'd never done any of that, because you write something and you're like, I think these relationships tend to work this way. This is how I see this character going, or this type of relationship going. Or is it just me? And then you just think like, if I'm honest with myself, people aren't so different. Like people will tend to probably be more similar to you than you would expect. And I think that's been like a really good lesson to learn from the nonfiction. And I really think that's like, I think that's a really nice thing it's given me, is that like, if you're honest with yourself, you will probably find that people agree with you more than you would anticipate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's like a great point. And also, you've written like a long piece, I think it was for The Cut, on Tinder and things. So you dive like really deeply into like the app and other things.
I love writing about dating because people, there's so much neurosis about it at the minute because people don't really get to talk about it. I love speaking to men particularly about it because they don't really have a network. Like with women, they don't actually get to like gripe to their friends that much about it. and they men all lie to each other about dates and stuff, like way more than I would ever. And I remember for that cup piece, I my brother is like 25, and I was just like to my brother, I was like, put me in touch with all the fuckboys, you know, like send me who you think of as like a lad, and let's I'll chat to them, because that's who I wanted to speak to. And they were like that, they were really interesting, like so much more neurotic than you would expect, like so much more, like, you know, they have a real, there was one guy, like really really funny guy actually, but he annoyingly he got cut from the piece, but he was like, he's like a real sort of like goes on one date, sleeps with someone, ghosts them kind of guy. But he was really like, oh, like it's he has like racked up so many of these women in the smallish town where he lives, and he's like terrified of seeing them. He like lives in fear of, and he ran into one of them at the gym, and he was like hiding behind the waist to avoid this woman, to kind of like to spare himself the awkwardness. And it was like, and he's so like, he's probably one of the most he comes off as really laddie, but when you speak to him about something like this, one of the most neurotic people I've ever spoken to, where he's like, oh, but if I sent a message and said to no more dates, then. But you see, then they would interpret it as this, and he's planned out this like real anxiety map in his head of like this terrible thing that's going to happen. And you kind of realize that this person who is like the easily viewed as like this kind of like villainous character has actually like got so much more baggage than you would anticipate. But I love writing about dating, particularly because like people just don't get to speak about it enough, and everybody has these stories that they haven't properly exercised, that they've been really stewing on for ages, and you can kind of speak to them for ages. I could probably write a whole book about dating, even though I always say,
you should.
I know, I always say I'm like the, because I've been in the same relationship for ages, I always say I'm like the dating correspondent who doesn't date. I'm always like, what's happening in the world of dating now, whereas I myself am not doing it. But I just love the like vulnerability of it.
Dating is the one place where people are like extremely openly vulnerable. Like I feel like you can lie or you will lie about your career or like your long-term relationship or whatever, but with dating you'll just come in and go, it was rubbish. you will get like, an honest response.
And it's a thing where like everybody actually has been on the sore end of it as well. It's like one where you would like, because you know, like I talked to this guy who was like a real serial ghoster, and not the sort of player, but like who was just a real ghoster, and he was like, oh, I've never done it in a serious way. And I was like, well, you know, like, when have you ever been ghosted? And he was like, oh yeah, like it was really bad actually when it happened to me. And it was really funny because he'd obviously done it loads, but he was like, oh, when it happened to me, no, that was bad though. But he was like, it was different when it happened to me because of this. Like everybody has their own like a schema of why it's, but it's it's really like kind of it's one more like even the most beautiful woman or like the most sort of like desirable man, like they'll still have had a situation that just didn't work out the way they wanted it to. It's a leveler, it's the great leveler.
Yeah, it is. And you see, it gets like I said, it's totally vulnerable, and you see into like people's like delusions and stuff. All of this is like great for fiction. So finally, my next question is, and you did mention it, you wrote my favorite piece during lockdown about gossip. And gossip,
oh, thank
dating,
you.
These are all, yeah, I sent it to everyone, like everyone.
That's so
I know.
Great to hear. That's so great to hear.
Because I'm a big gossip, and I finally saw myself
reflected.
But I was, you said it there as well, but you were saying it was kind of a break from the kind of weird moralizing that existed during lockdown, and it acknowledged the universal truth, I'm quoting, that people are all crazy and they drive each other mad. Can you talk to me about writing this essay?
Oh yeah, so it was actually good that I'd had this Felix, who's like a good friend of mine, who's an artist. He always has really funny gossip because he just like, people just tell him stuff, like they just kind of like go off in a big rant at him, and he does just listen. And so he always has really funny stories, and he lives in a warehouse in London normally, and it was just like really chaotic during lockdown, like loads of like anti-vaxxers and stuff. So he just like sort of fled back home to, he's from Cambridge. And like everyone who, he's a wee bit younger than me, and they're just a bit like, you know, like most of his friends weren't very settled, so they all kind of went back to Cambridge. And it was just like this sort of like reheated like adolescence where everyone was just like getting drunk all the time in these fields and like sort of like swaggering up to like their high school crush and kind of like having out with them. So it was like he was giving me, would have these weekly phone calls, and he was giving me these missives for what was happening in Cambridge. And the story emerged, which was like the key story of the gossip piece that we were just talking about for ages. And then it was actually just that I thought it would be a nice piece, but I was like, don't really know how to do it. And then the Jordan, who's the editor, has it, who's like such a fab editor, I think, he was like, do you want to do this year in review piece? You can write about anything you want. Like, and I was like, they could work for this. So I was like, why do we do the year in gossip? And I'll do that as the main piece, and I'll structure it like, have that as the main piece, and then I'll do all my other gossips, and I'll just bring it out and make it a little bit about the moralism thing, so it has a kind of like thing to it. And he was like, yeah, that sounds good, let's do that. And he actually, like, I thought he did it really well, because he didn't really touch it too much after, because it's not structurally, it's not like that normal, because it's got this big long introduction and stuff, and it works for it. But I think some editors would have been, it's why it's nice to write for places that aren't always like The Guardian or the New York Times or whatever, because you have to, it does have to fit in a mold, where it's for them, whereas with other places it doesn't. And I think you can kind of push out what an essay can actually do with some of these other places a lot better. But yeah, he didn't really like touch too much, he just tidies up a bit. And then it was like, yeah, I thought it was really fun, because it was like so much, so many of these stories I'd collected that had actually kept me going a lot through lockdown, that I'd kind of been getting, I'd been sort of, every time I checked in with my friend, I'd been like, you know, not just Felix, but any of the other stories, I'd be nice to tell me what's happening with that thing. And then we sort of do that. And I put bringing them all together, I was kind of like, oh, this has actually been my year of sitting in the house, has actually more been about this. Like, this is kind of, this has been like more, this has been my project almost. Mm-hmm. And so it was like nice to have a space to kind of bring it together in that way. But it was nice, I think it kind of resonated with people in a way, because it was so random, like, because there was like all of these collections of just like weird stuff that was going on. But it was like really, it was really nice though, because after it, like, so many people, I felt like a priest, like, so many people emailed me their own gossip. Like, I was getting like all of these emails and like DMs.
Oh my God,
and, like,
that's on every dream.
It was so good. It was like everyone was like sending me all of this stuff from Australia or whatever, like totally random people just being like, oh, like, just thought you would be interested in the story. And it was all like, and it was nice to have it, like, yeah, you kind of realize like how much everyone's been doing more or less the same stuff.
Yeah, I feel that, like, you know, I come from like a pretty small town and thing, and I feel that, like, gossip is so influential on my, like, like, just my process as a writer. Like, I think it's what really, like, made me a writer. I really do think that. So that's why I
the gossip and scandal. Yeah, yeah.
Gossip, and just hearing little bits, just enough about people to kind of form a story, you know?
It's funny as well, because the with that gossip piece, there was but the main story, which was, you know, like, one guy cheated on his brother and all of this stuff, people really were like, oh, like, Samuel was completely in the right there. And it was like really funny, because people always split, like, you know, everyone sees it as their way and doesn't see it necessarily. But so many people would be like, and it was so clear that it was X, but it actually, to me, I thought the first one was in the right. But the I didn't know the people who were in, like, the main story. I just heard it from Felix, and they sort of exist in this wider friend group I'm part of, so like I never met them. I knew who roughly one of them was, but I never met them. And I was at a wedding like last summer, and I bumped into him, and he came up to me and he was like, it's you. And I was like, oh God, it's God, me. Yeah. And he was like, you put me on the radio. And I was like, I'm so sorry. And he was very good humor, but it was so funny, because he was like, it's okay though, because at the end I did come off the best in that story. So I was like everybody would see it that way.
That's the only way to kind of do it. Oh, thank you, Rachel. That was wonderful.
Lovely to chat.
It was really lovely to chat, and thank you for coming on. And I'm looking forward to your novel next year and your new pieces.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to your book as well, very much so.
Well, full of gossip. Thanks, Rachel.
But yeah, lovely to chat.
Thank you for listening. Thank you to the Arts Council for their support, and we'll see you again soon.